Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Well, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron has just published a new book. It's called Queenpins, Notorious Women Gangsters from the Modern Era. He's an award-winning author based in South Carolina. He's the author of 31 books, including Sergeant Smack, The Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin and His Band of Brothers, and the just-published Straight from the Hood, Amazing but True Gangster Tales. He's also the producer of two award-winning documentaries. Get out there and buy these books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed. Ron is also a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland documentary series and publisher of Strategic Media Books. You can go to www.strategicmediabooks.com. Also, be sure to visit his website, Ron Chepsik. That's www.ronchepsik.com. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Also, he's a two-time Fulbright scholar who represented Bangladesh and Indonesia. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio of my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. This year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. And early next year, another book will be out about the famous Ginalda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Always appreciated. Yeah, our book is really going selling well. And I'd like to thank our one of our sponsors, Simpson's Deli on in Thunder Bay, Canada. Great thank you for them to stock the books on the shelves. Now, Crime Beat's special featured guest tonight is Luella Smiley. She joins us from New Mexico, United States. She's the daughter of Alan Smiley, friend of the infamous mobster Bugsy Siegel. The 1947 murder of the Las Vegas mobster and Vegas visionary Benjamin Bugsy Siegel has never been solved. But there's no shortage of theories. Only one person witnessed the slaying: Siegel's best friend and fellow gangster, Alan Smiley. Luellen Smiley will talk about her father and the legendary gangster and share her insights and research on mob history. It's going to be a great show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Now, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some of the mail we received over the last week, you know, we're thrilled and delighted to announce we're getting over 130,000 listeners a week. And we'd like to thank our production staff over there at Artist First Radio, particularly Corey, Scott, and Tony, for making it possible. Like I said many times before, Ron, Internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Now, here is this week's mailbag. Hey, Ronnie, this one is from Duncan of Cape Town, South Africa, who writes, "I was introduced to your show by a friend of mine from Johannesburg. She's listened to your last five broadcasts and urged me to give the show a listen, since she thinks I'm a crime buff. Well, I was pleasantly surprised. Thank you very much. Your show is lively, and like your guest Jack Garcia said last week, you guys have the right chemistry. And most importantly, judging by the archive titles that I'm tuning into, you guys are coming up with a very interesting subject. Keep it up, gents." Hey, Ronnie, any comments?
Yeah, we do have interesting subjects, but do you feel chemistry? I mean, they always say there's chemistry between... do you feel some kind of, some kind of...
Yeah.
Chemicals moving between us?
Well, it's like
through the air from Thunder Bay, Canada, to Rock Hill.
It's a kindred experience. Like we're in the same we're in the amniotic fluid of broadcasting.
Yeah, well, we'll thank Duncan of Cape Town for that kind comment, and glad he's listening to the show.
Well, thanks for that, Duncan. Now, well, this one is from Bill of South Florida. He writes, "Are you guys really from Canada? I was there for 6 years when I jumped basic training in San Diego before our Da Nang deployment. Canada is number one, man. You've got a terrific show. Love the different topics." Hey, Ronnie, that's the great comments. Any remarks on that?
Yeah, that show's even tracked that draft dodgers, right? I forgot all about that. That was an important part of Canadian history. All these young Americans didn't want to go fight it in Vietnam. And
absolutely.
Went to. Whatever happened to these guys?
Well, a lot of the guys stayed. A lot of them went back when Carter did the amnesty back there in 1980, I believe it was. But a lot of them stayed here, raised families. I think there was a couple who ended up in Parliament. So they were productive citizens. We're really happy for them.
Got any famous serial killers?
Yeah. Well, anyway, Ronnie, you want to give our listeners out there in that wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show and tell us what you're up to in the next week or two. I hear you're going to be a pretty busy hombre.
Right. Next week, we'll have Sylvia Longmire is going to be talking about the problems on the border with Mexico. She's an expert on the subject, so we're really looking forward to having her share her insights. As for what I'm doing, we had a great turnout last week at North Carolina Central University Law School in Durham. Ike Atkinson, who's the subject of my book, Sergeant Smack, we had over 600 students there teleconferencing in and listening in person, and it was a great experience. Listeners can go to our website, strategicmediabooks.com. My Queen Pins is available there, and J. Patrick O'Connor just came out with a really interesting book on a death row case in California and the injustice surrounding it. The death row inmate is Kenneth Cooper. Willie?
Well, that's great, Ronnie. I'm really happy for your success. Way to go. Now, now just before we continue with the show, we bring you some sad news from L.A. As you know, Soul Train creator and host Don Cornelius, who brought R&B into Americans' living rooms. He was found dead early yesterday morning, apparent suicide. You know, the 75-year-old Cornelius, he was a visionary. Any comments?
Yeah, I mean, we grew up with this show, right? I mean, 1971 it started, and I was amazed at how many white people really liked the show. I was listening to NBC, and NBC was really...
You are listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. All past broadcasts can be downloaded free and on demand. Visit the archives at artistfirst.com. Let's go back to your host, Will and Ron.
Yeah, we had a slight technical glitch there, Willie, but we were talking about Don Cornelius and what a sad day it was when to hear that he passed away.
Yeah.
We thought it was a crime story at first. You know, we learned that he was shot, but evidently he committed suicide, and he had a lot of problems in recent years. He was 76 years old, but as I was saying, we grew up with this show in 1971. I was amazed watching TV how many whites, people like ourselves, loved the show. And, you know, it was a tremendously, it was a cultural icon, show, Soul Train. Right,
tremendous loss. You know, this guy, hippest trip in America. He presented stars like Smokey Robinson, Barry White, Aretha Franklin. He was a great star. May he rest in peace.
Right,
peace. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops, and never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present a rap sheet part of the program. A rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Here is this week's rap sheet item number one. Dateline, Kingston, Canada, January 29th, 2012. Afghan family convicted of murdering four relatives in Canadian honor killing. Irani, a Canadian jury on Sunday found three members of an Afghan family guilty of killing three teenage sisters and another woman in what the judge described as a cold-blooded, shameful murder resulting from a twisted concept of honor. Any comments?
Well, yeah, every once in a while you hear this this story, and unfortunately it casts a bad light, you know, on the Muslim religion. Just for our listeners to know what an honor killing is, it's a murder by families of another family member who was believed to have brought shame on the family name. And evidently there was four people that got killed in this, you know, two of the daughters, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, a common-law wife that was living in a polygamous relationship, and they had the father on tape, Muhammad Shafia, and he has showed no remorse, you know, for the killings. He got 25 years. Yeah. And it was really amazing. He was a rich guy, wasn't he, Willie?
Absolutely, really big time. He had an inheritance from his relatives in Afghanistan. Apparently, he came here about 15 years ago, and then he started up a business in Montreal at a strip mall. He had various businesses,
and he had his old world ways, right?
Absolutely.
The tribal village is really amazing.
You know, it's too bad. It's a sad story,
yeah.
The son is on appeal, so the story is still going to happen. So we'll keep an eye on that one. Well, Ronnie, let's get on to rap sheet item number two. Dateline, January 31st, New York City. Marijuana worth $7.5 million found over four floors of a New York apartment building. Hey, Ron, cops raided a New York apartment building Tuesday and found it had been turned into a pot farm. Acting on a tip, police broke down the door at a Moore Street, Park Avenue in the Bronx, and found a staggering 600 marijuana growing plants. You know, they filled the top of four floors of a five-story building. Any thoughts on this?
It's really amazing in a number of ways. Gives new meaning to the term urban jungle. Did you see the pictures of those marijuana plants there?
Wow.
And second of all, how could these guys figure that they could get away with this? You know, in the heart of, you know, in the Bronx, you know, which is the heart of New York City. And as you pointed out, the electricity bill was the thing that gave them away.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a fascinating story. It just shows you the entrepreneurship of these guys. Unfortunately, they went the wrong way of the law, and they're going to pay for it.
That's right. It's a metaphor for the war on drugs. You know,
as long as
you have demand, you're going to have supply, and people are going to do anything to get it to the people that want it.
Yeah, you got that right. Now, just before we get on to our very special guest, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Hareb. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have any questions for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you, and we'll try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, tonight's featured and very special guest is Llewellyn Smiley. Llewellyn is a daughter, was the daughter of Alan Smiley, business partner and best friend of Bugsy Siegel. You know, murder cases don't get much bigger than the Bugsy Siegel assassination. It's easily the most significant crime in Las Vegas history. Even though it occurred in California, the unsolved murder of Siegel put Las Vegas on the map. And tonight, Llewellyn Smiley will discuss this fascinating story of her father and notorious and deadly mobster, Bugsy Siegel. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Llewellyn Smiley.
Thank you. How are you?
Fine. Great. I really enjoyed researching your background. You've really got an interesting background, especially in terms of employment. You've managed a 60s rock and roll photography gallery in Santa Fe, a hip-hop Afro jazz dance troupe in San Diego. You've leased property. I think you have a vacation rental now, right, that you're running, managing?
Yes. Yes, yeah. The photography gallery turned into
right,
a vacation
right,
rental.
Right.
So.
Yeah, you just get bored with things, or
I do. I'm a gangster at heart, I guess. You know?
You're a gangster at heart, so you're always looking for the next opportunity, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, it runs in the blood, you know.
Right. And you also publish a column, Smiley's Dice, which
Smiley's Dice. Yeah,
right, which
it's
is
published. It's published on my website, Growing Up With Gangsters. And I write quite a bit about growing up with gangsters. I've done probably 50 or 60 columns on that. But I also write about just adventures in life and creative nonfiction in terms of life, people that I meet.
Right.
Different. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your background, and then we'll talk about your father and move on to his relationship with Bugsy Siegel and other aspects of gangster mob history. Where were you born?
In Los Angeles.
And your father, your mother's name was it Lucille Casey?
Yes. Yeah. Very good, Lucille Casey.
Right. Well, I was doing research on you. I was amazed. She was an entertainer in her own right. Right.
She was. She was a model, and then she was working at the Copacabana, which is where she met my father.
Right.
And she was a Powers model from New York. Have you heard of, Powers
model? Oh, yeah. And unfortunately, she died young. I think it was like 44 years old in 66, was it? In 1966.
Yes, it was.
Right.
Absolutely.
On that then. Right. And so you had this really famous mother, and you had this father. Did you know what he did? Because he was involved with the mob, right? Alan Smiley, when you were growing up.
Right. No, you wouldn't know, especially in the Jewish culture. This is something that's hidden, very, very well hidden. And regardless of what whispers I might have heard at school or what I read in a book in the Greenfelt jungle, there was absolutely no way that my father was involved in any of that.
Right.
Even until I was like in my late 30s.
Right, right. Now, give us a little background on your father. One interesting thing, I understand, he was Canadian, right? He came from Canada? And
yes. His family left Russia, in 1900, early 1900s, when he was a young boy escaping the oppression there of the Jewish people, and landed in Winnipeg, Canada, and he wanted to be a hockey player. His father wanted him to be a rabbi, so he ran away from home when he was about 13. And came to Detroit and landed there. And I think that's possibly where he started meeting up with some of these guys. He was very young. They hung out in pool halls and so forth. And then he made his way from Detroit to New York, traveled with the circus, the Ringling Brothers, and ended up in Los Angeles.
Right.
And that was in about 1927. He served. Should I keep going?
No. This is interesting because he sounds a little bit like you. You know, in his peripatetic journey through life with all these different careers. Isn't that right?
It is right. He's always been my idol in terms of taking chances in life and So, yeah, I'm sure I do have some of that. But I right. think he had a lot more fun than I did,
right.
or I do.
Well, you know, what was he like? And what did he look like? And what was he like? Describe for our listeners a little bit about him.
Well, he was a very handsome man. He was him and Ben together. People have told me they were just devastating to see them walk together because they were both so handsome. They look kind of alike, you know, mm-hmm. 6 feet, dark hair. Ben was jealous of my dad because my dad had more hair than him, mm-hmm. and blue eyes, mm-hmm. and you know, charming personalities that were fearless and. Just enigmatic, you know, bigger than life kind of guys.
Right.
They were just different.
Right. Well, was he proud of his Jewishness? And you know, did he face discrimination as well during this era?
Oh,
you know,
sure.
This was a very
yes.
bad era, you know, for him, for Jewish people.
Well, it was bad there, and it was bad here. I mean, one of the reasons I'm on the air is because. When I did start breaking my silence and dug into his history and wanted to understand what my roots were, I discovered that there was nothing but trigger-happy murderers running around. This is the only portrayal that you see on movies and in books, except for a few authors who have, you know, sort of embellished the
right.
Jewish gangster. But they faced it here, and they were the ones that stood up, like in New Jersey, the Minutemen, they stood up to the brown shirts.
Mm-hmm.
They sent money to pre-state Israel. I mean,
right.
they set an example for a lot of Jewish people during the 30s when nobody was.
Right. Now, I've never read this anywhere, but I was thinking, is that one of the reasons that Bugsy Siegel, Benjamin Siegel, and your father were drawn to each other was their Jewish backgrounds?
I'm sure that was one of them. The gambling was another. Like I started to say, the difference with my dad is he came into it very late. He was a producer and worked for Cecil B. DeMille in Hollywood for about 10 years mm-hmm. before he met Ben Siegel. And after he met Ben, he left his business.
Right.
That's what was shocking.
Right. Well, now, how did he come to Hollywood? Because that's a very interesting part of his career. He jumped
out
of a famous
yeah.
people. Tell us about
that's
that.
That's one of the few stories he did share with me. He was, when he got to Los Angeles after New York, I guess he married very young. He was probably 18 mm-hmm. to another woman and robbed a drugstore and was caught
mm-hmm.
and was sent to reform school. And he didn't want to go back to Canada. So, because he was underage, actually,
right.
17. And Cecil B. DeMille came down to the reformatory to do some research for a film called The Godless Girl
mm-hmm.
and took notice of my dad, or my dad made some sort of gesture to get notice, which is probably the, mm-hmm. the way it went, and said he wanted to work in the movie business. And so Cecil said, when you get out of the reform school, you come down and I'll have a job for you. So that's how it started, and he did. He hitched a ride down and stayed with him for, yeah, like 10 years.
Wow. What did he do for Cecil B.?
Well, he started out as a graph and worked in wardrobe and worked his way up to assistant
yeah.
producer.
Well, he must have been good-looking. I understand that he attracted the attention of Carol Lombard. Is that true?
Yes, yes.
She was a beauty in her day, too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right. What kind of relationship they have?
He didn't tell me that. I know that he went out with her, and I think she was too fiery for him. My father was a very, yeah, she,
low key,
she you know.
Your father was low key, right?
Well, no, he had to be in control.
Right.
You know,
right.
He had to be in control then, and he couldn't compete with Clark Gable, come on.
That's true. I mean, Clark had everything, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I think they made a better couple.
Right. Well, he was evidently good friends with one of my all-time favorite actors, who really was a gangster, George Raft, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yep. Georgie came to all my birthday parties. They were great pals, and you know, so much is made of the relationship and whether George was a gangster or not. But I think a lot of that is a fallacy. I really believe, and there's a lot been written about, but I really believe that they just they knew each other from New York.
Right.
So obviously they're going to get together out here.
Right.
And, yeah, and he took a lot of his portrayals from the guys that he hung out with,
right,
like Ben, and, yeah.
Well, as a journalist, I'm interested in this story, particularly because your father didn't talk about it much, and he died when you were young, right?
Oh, well, I was 30.
Oh,
no.
you're 30 on that. But yeah, you researched his life. So how did you find all this fascinating information if he didn't talk to you?
I had to go to the government, which was really odd because as you're growing up in this lifestyle, which is so completely different,
right,
you're really brainwashed that you do not ask questions. You don't ask questions. You just listen to what they tell you.
Right.
And I was told that there was no such thing as the mafia when I confronted my father one time. And all of the people that he hung out with and that I met were all my uncles. And it didn't matter, no matter how tough and, you know, obvious it was, that
right,
this guy wasn't my uncle and he wasn't selling shoes during the day.
Right.
You just believe it.
Right.
So I had to go to the FBI and did the whole Freedom of Information Act request. Back then it wasn't online. It took me 3 years to get the files. And then the INS, because he never, part of his problem was he never registered as a alien, because they would have sent him back, because he had a conviction. And so volumes of documents came from the government, and books and interviews with people,
wow,
his friends, and so all of it just
and they released all that information. That was pretty good. Did you have to fight for it to be released?
Yes, I did.
So how'd you fight for it?
I had to go to this office in L.A. The woman wouldn't open the door. They admit. I'll never forget this.
But what'd she do?
She wouldn't open the door, and she. I had to call a D.C. Oh, I mean, there was no stopping me, but there was. It was classified, and they didn't want to release
right, the
INS files. And I came to find out it was because he put together such an amazing fight. They wanted to deport him to Russia.
Right.
He was so close to being deported.
Oh, wow.
So once I went through his history, I had a whole new respect for him and how he juggled a family and the mob and the government. I mean, they practically lived with us.
Right.
You're under
surveillance. I got a quick question for Llewellyn, if you don't mind, Ronnie.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, Llewellyn, you mentioned that you first discovered your father's past when somebody showed you the book, The Greenfield Jungle. What was your
right,
reaction when you found out about your father's past? What did you feel? Because obviously your father didn't tell you about his past when you were growing up.
Well, you mean the first time I saw that book?
I was
only about 13, and my mother just died. I didn't know anything about my dad other than he was, you know, a great horseback rider, and he loved to take me out to dinner and introduce me to his friends. But so I really didn't. I just didn't believe it. You know, I just erased it. The contrast between the man that I saw walking around Beverly Hills waving at everybody and having lunch and so forth just didn't go along with this other character that people were telling me about. So it wasn't really until I turned 40 and I suddenly said, that I've got to find out who I come from.
So it was difficult.
It was very difficult. I mean, I read all the books, the murders and the butcher and the... They do this, and they, you know, all the awful, awful things,
mm-hmm,
and that part you have to really understand that those rules were made for them, okay? Because they didn't have protection here. You throw a million Jews, Irish, Italians in the Lower East Side, and say fend for yourself, you're going to get a gang.
Right. Well, let's take a quick break, and we'll get back, and we'll move on to talking about Alan Smiley's relationship with Bugsy Siegel. Willie?
Fascinating guest with Llewellyn. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chetsick and yours truly. Our special featured guest this evening is Llewellyn Smiley. Now back to Ron and Miss Llewellyn Smiley.
Thank you, Willie. And we're back with Llewellyn Smiley. The daughter of Alan Smiley, and She has a website, www.growingupwithgangsters.com, where you can read her column, Smiley's Dice. You're on Facebook too, right? And Twitter?
Yes, not Twitter, Facebook.
Okay, you're on Facebook. You can also join. And you haven't done a book yet. I'm just curious why you haven't done a book yet. You're obviously a writer.
I did do a book. In fact, I did about 17 versions of the book.
published.
And I had an agent, and unfortunately, when you have this subject, they really want violence. And my father wasn't a violent man. He was more of a negotiator.
Yeah. Right.
So I have a script that's finished. We have an agent for it who's circulating that. And I might do a book. It may not be exactly like what people think in terms of, you know, because I've done so much of this writing in terms of my columns.
Right.
But because you go through cycles with this. The last cycle, the most interesting cycle, if you want to hear,
sure.
is how breaking my silence and writing about this, who it brought to me. It brought me into that world, into my father's friends, into people that had heard about him. The doorman at the apartment building where I lived found me. I mean, I can't even go, you know, just all these people just found me. And so I was able to compare stories and sort of get reunited with my roots. That was really fascinating.
Right. And of course, you're resurrecting your father's story for history, right? You've given it a history.
Yes.
Because otherwise he probably would have been forgotten. You know, a long time ago, but you've actually honoring his memory in that way.
I am.
Right.
I really am.
Well, we're talking about your father, and we talked briefly about Bugsy Siegel. How did they meet, and what year, and what was the occasion?
You know, even with everybody I've spoken to, even Ben Siegel's daughter, it's never been really determined how they met. It's pretty obvious that they probably met through George Raft, because my dad was friends with him. Mm-hmm. Possibly Johnny Roselli, another big figure in the Los Angeles mob scene. And Ben went to Hollywood, and he was organizing a union there, and I'm sure that's where he met my dad,
right.
Either through George or through Roselli, and they were inseparable, and my father worshipped him,
right.
Absolutely worshipped him.
Maybe you should give a little background on who Bugsy Siegel was. What did your research reveal about Bugsy Siegel? And how did he get that name, Bugsy? That's not a particularly flattering name.
Well, only because he was fiery and he was, you know, quick impulse person. I mean, he was hot-blooded.
Right.
So, in other words, if there was any kind of trouble, Ben would go first into the crowd and protect his family, his neighborhood, whatever. And sometimes he overreacted, so that's where he got the name. But, you know, he's so one-dimensional. They call him a psychopath and a murderer, and this, like, he went around and he enjoyed murdering. This wasn't this guy. This wasn't him at all.
Well, he did commit murders, though, didn't he? I mean, he did commit murder.
Well, yeah, because Murder, Inc. originally was for that purpose, for the people that were,
right.
you know, hitting on each other's gangs.
Right.
But that didn't last that long, and I think the last murder he was accused of was in 37 or 42, when he was never convicted.
Right.
He was more about protection than he was, I think, actually going around murdering, but that's the way it's been written, you know, in from the beginning of time, I guess, that this is the way this guy operated. But he also took care of his family. He supported his family. He bought his sister a house. I mean, his daughters adored him.
Mm-hmm.
His friends, everybody that I've met, obviously not the ones that he hurt, but said that this was a larger-than-life character, and he was the one that they sent him to protect, you know, the booze coming across. That's really where it
right.
came from. That he, well, yeah, you see that in Boardwalk Empire and
right.
so forth.
Well, obviously, he pissed off the powers that be in the mafia and it cost him his life. We'll talk a little bit about that famous incident in a little bit. But what did your father do, you know, as a gangster and working with Bugsy Siegel? Were you able to determine that?
Well, yeah, they did a lot of things. I mean, they were always changing their businesses, but the main business was the wire service in Los Angeles. And when they Ben brought that in and opened up a competitive wire service to the one in Chicago, he had to go around and convince all the bookies to go with Ben's service. But Ben actually opened a nightclub for my dad on Sunset as well. And then they went into the metals business, and then they tried to list in the Army. And then they had floating casinos, you know, off Santa Monica Bay. And then they went to the Flamingo, and my dad invested in that. And that's where it was all going to start to be legitimate.
Right.
You know, people forget, aside from all of the violence and delivering the illegal services to people that are the ones that usually shun them first, they brought nightclubs and casinos. Now every state has a lottery.
Mm-hmm.
You
and
know, people
and,
are getting...
And your father... he actually liked to gamble as well, right? Not just run gambling establishment. And you said Bugsy was the same way. What type of gambling were they interested in? And did they win, or, I mean, was it a problem?
They gambled on everything. They gambled on whether the fly would get through the window or not. I'm serious.
Who won that
they
bet?
Gambled.
Who won that bet?
All... My father gambled, oh, so much, up to $50,000 a day, Ben much more. On all the sporting events, all the elections, horse racing, Academy Awards, I mean, everything. This was the essence of these guys.
Wow.
You know, that's what makes them so different.
Yeah, Llewellyn.
They approach, yes.
Yeah. You know, gamblers don't really succeed in life. Did your father
no.
die? Did he die a poor man?
Unfortunately, he did. That's the tragedy. None of them. Very few of these guys ended up with any money.
The gangsters, right. That's my research I found out, too. They really have bad lives as they get older.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they don't live for the future, because they
right.
know that they may not have one. I mean,
right.
I think in the 50s it was reported that the organized crime brought in something like $20 billion.
Right.
Arnold Rothstein won $800,000 on one horse.
Right.
The numbers
wow.
were... Yeah, mind-boggling.
Right. I know some writers described your father as a dope peddler. I think one writer I read somewhere where he described him as a pimp. The way you talk about him, he didn't sound like he was those things. He was, like you said, more of a negotiator, more of a...
They wanted to pin that on him. The government, the FBI tried... You can't even imagine. They had a task force up and down the coast of California trying to... connect this white traffic, you know, from
right.
Sacramento all the way down to Mexico. These leaders like Meyer, like Longy, like Ben, my dad, not a leader, but very tight with Ben, they were absolutely against narcotics. What happened after that, they passed narcotics, but
right.
these guys wouldn't go near it.
I would imagine that J. Edgar Hoover is not one of your favorite characters from American history. Because we talk about the FBI during that period. Hoover was the FBI, right? And he collected all kinds of files, and he was relentless. If he wanted to go after you, if he wanted to go after you and try to destroy you, he had the power to do it.
Yeah, he did. He did. He pretty much destroyed. What happened after Ben died was murders. My father... who was sitting 2 feet next to him on the sofa, he completely freaked out. I mean, this was the first real introduction to the other side of what he was doing.
Right.
Up that close. And he went to Meyer in New York and asked to get out. And
yeah, you're speaking about Meyer Lansky, of course.
Meyer Lansky, yeah. This is all stories that are passed down through the different family members, and he was very, very fortunate. He, after the murder, went underground because he was supposedly getting death threats, and he was also under indictment for this claiming, you know, American citizenship on a booking slip, so they were about to deport him. He met a wildcatter in Texas who wanted to take him under his wing, give him a job, And my father married my mother at that time after he had, you know, agreed to reform, and they moved down to Houston. And he had oil wells. He was starting the business. Then he had to go to prison and serve a year and a half. He came out, asked to relocate, live in Houston, and be on parole in Houston and Hoover. And I saw the notes. I mean, I saw the handwritten note. No, send him back to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. He'll go bankrupt, and then we can get him. Wow. He'll go back to the racket. So, yeah, Hoover really had a vendetta for Ben and for my dad because they offered him immunity, and he wouldn't take it.
Right. Willie, let's take a station break, and we'll come back with our fascinating guest discussing her father's life with Ben Bugsy Siegel. Willie?
You bet. Ronnie, a very, very special guest tonight. Very intriguing story on Alan Smiley and Ben Siegel. At this time, we'll do a station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly. Our special guest is Llewellyn Smiley. Now back to Ron and Llewellyn.
Right. And to learn more about Llewellyn Smiley, listeners can go to www.growingupwithgangsters.com. That's her website. And Llewellyn's also on Facebook, and you can join her there. Let's backtrack a little and talk about that famous night where Bugsy Siegel was killed, and your father was there a few feet away from him. Give us a little background on what happened. I referred to the fact that Bugsy had pissed off the mob. I mean, he really got him angry that they put out a hit on him. Talk about that. And he was building this hotel, you know, the Flamingo, and it was supposed to be a big move for the mafia. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Well, everybody has a theory on that that studied it, and there's so many contradictions in it, but there was a lot of things going on. There was Ben, who had transformed himself out here in California, I mean, and then in Las Vegas, and was getting more and more distant from his, you know, his Eastern ties, and became very, very powerful out here. The wire service was another big problem. The loss of the money at the Flamingo, I don't buy that theory, because it was only $5 or $6 million, and that's not really a lot to them.
Right.
I did discover that his right-hand guy, Mo Sedway, was an informant.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's possible that there was a collaboration between some of the East Coast guys, and the Los Angeles mob and the FBI.
Well, you think the FBI could have been involved with it?
Well, why was Mo Sedway an informant?
Right.
Only because he's informing on Ben.
Right, right.
And they couldn't get Ben. Can you imagine trying to chase this guy since 1929?
Right.
And they can't get him.
Right, right, right. Well, your father was sitting a few feet away on the couch. What was he doing there at that night?
Oh, they had gone out to dinner. Ben had just come in from Vegas. They were together all day, and Ben was just taking care of some business. He was actually waiting for his girls to come in and take him on a vacation.
Right.
And so they were just sitting there reading the newspaper. My father got up. He heard a noise, and this all came from another source who studied this extensively and has his own book, Warren Hull. My father heard a noise, got up and opened up the front drape to look out and see if he saw anything, and he didn't. The shot didn't come from the front window, it came from the side window.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but quite a few historians and journalists have pointed to my dad as the point man, which is another reason that got me very involved in this whole history. My father wouldn't choose to sit 2 feet next to the man if
right.
he knew he was going to be shot.
He never carried a gun, did he?
No. God, no. And he told me the story one night
right.
of what happened.
Right.
So it was, you know, in fact, the case is still open. They won't close the case. They have my father's jacket because one of the bullets went right through the sleeve.
Mm-hmm. But they eventually... dismissed your father as a potential.
They yes, they took him in for a night, and then he was released, and he was so terrified. He had one of the Cleveland guys, Lou Rothkopf, come out and stay with him, because the whole thing was, you know, it just blew up into all proportions. But
well, they were staying at Virginia Hill's house, right? Who was a really interesting character.
Yes.
You know, the so-called mob queen. I've written about her in my new book called Mob Queens. She wasn't there at that time, right?
No, she had gone to Paris.
Right. And do you think that she had something to do with it? They had a really tempestuous, her and Bugsy had a tempestuous relationship.
Yeah.
Do you think that somehow she might have been involved with it?
You know what? I wish I knew. You know, I really do. Everything I've read seems sort of, it's, you know, like they say in the mob world, there are no coincidences. Yeah, she happened to be in Paris. Yeah,
right.
She left, what, 4 or 5 days earlier.
Right.
I don't know, to tell you the truth. I just don't know.
Did you talk with your father about whether Bugsy had any foreshadowing that he was really in deep trouble with somebody, you know, in the mob world?
Well, yeah, it was obvious. I mean, he really was not listening. He was not taking orders at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And he had his own agenda, and he really wanted to... This flamingo in Vegas was an enormous dream.
Right.
And, yeah, people have dreams like that. They get carried away. It's a human condition.
Right. But ironically, Las Vegas turned out to be the vision, right?
Yeah.
You know, it turned out to be everything that Bugsy envisioned, and your father went on with his life, but it was never the same, right? He lost his best friend, and he almost, you know, he was at a scene at a horrific killing. And so what happened? I mean, he left, he got cleared by the police, so he went on with his life, and what did he do?
Well, like I said, after that, he wanted to get into the oil business, and when they wouldn't let him relocate to Houston, he came back to L.A. and settled in Bel Air and tried to run his business, but Hoover was right. He couldn't. You can't do oil exploration from your house. You have to go to the oil wells, you know. And at one point, he had, I think, 12 wells.
Wow.
Eventually, it sort of, he still had oil income, but not enough, so he did have to go back to the rackets and just be a sort of a peripheral figure in terms of introductions, entertainment, you know, sort of a host. I think he was the host is what I read in the FBI files, that they met at at our house, and he would make everything comfortable for everybody, kind of thing.
Llewellyn, you mentioned that your dad died when you were 30 years old. In your dad's old age, did he ever confide in you? Did he ever say that he regretted his life, and if he had to do it over again, he would do something different?
He said that there's no way I could make more mistakes than he did, even if I lived to 100. So I don't think he really regretted, especially the family. I know that part. He didn't regret, you know, my mother or having us, and he really devoted his life to us. But I think what he regretted was the gambling and getting involved with with that world. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, how do you feel about your father's legacy? You know, you've learned a lot about him. A lot of it is not pleasant. You know, in terms of, you know, being a mobster and all that. How do you feel about your father today?
I have to tell you, after I really discovered his story, I was more proud of it, and that's why I'm talking about it.
Right.
Because this is an unusual circumstance where a gentleman goes in and then wants to go out and is able to get out of it, at least temporarily.
Right.
And to be able to juggle the secrecy while he's raising two daughters was I have no idea how he did it, but he did. He was some actor. And I tell you something, those guys, the way they live, they gain a lot of wisdom. And he passed on as much as he could to me about how to survive and be competent and be generous.
Right. And your life turned out well. I mean, you've got a very interesting life.
I have an interesting life.
Yeah,
I do.
You're a success.
Ever changing.
Right, by all standards. Do you talk with other relatives and children of mobsters.
Yes.
About your experience. I know a lot of them have trouble dealing with their past.
We're all very dysfunctional. Because we are a separate culture because we grow up with such extreme privileges.
Right.
And at the same time, so much shame. I mean, one of my questions, what do you think? If you went around and interviewed the population of the United States, what would be the percentage that really disapprove of the gangster of the 40s, 50s, 60s, whatever, and think that there's something wrong with their offspring?
You know, it's a love-hate relationship. But, you know, people always say, "Oh, the mobster," but they just every mobster movie that comes out, everybody wants to see the next one. I mean, the people are fascinated by the mob.
I mean,
that's one of the probably the most fascinating aspect of American culture. You know, even more than Hollywood,
I think is
the mob. Don't you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what's so fascinating to us is that they think we're so fascinating.
Right. And it keeps us on the air. And it keeps you writing about it.
It does. You know. Yeah. And the kids, we all do have a commonality and a certain trust just because we know, we understand each other.
Right. We run out of time, unfortunately, and I have one last question. Will you ever stop researching your family story?
I have stopped researching, really, but it's not that I'm... Even if I've stopped, it still comes to me through other people and through other stories. So even though I'm not reading any more, FBI documents, I've read them and reread them and reread them, but stories come to me from meeting other people, and that's always interesting. I like that.
Thank you, Llewellyn Smile. This has been a real pleasure. We could go on and on. And
I think so, too.
But we'll get you back on again. Keep us informed about what you're doing. We have a former guest on periodically, and especially if you got a book out, we'll get you back on.
Okay, wonderful. Okay. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it, too.
Thank you, Llewellyn, and have a great evening.
Okay, same to you.
Willie?
Thanks, Llewellyn. Appreciate it. Well, thanks, Ronnie, and thanks again to our very special guest, Miss Llewellyn Smiley. We're privileged to have her on the program. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about her interview tonight?
Well, I think Llewellyn is an engaging personality. You could talk about her father and mob history. And Alan Smiley was certainly an interesting story. And I think Llewellyn's research is just amazing.
Yeah.
I was able to piece together, because I know from my own personal experience, when you write about gangsters, that's not the easiest thing to research because there's so much missing information. How about you, Willie?
Well, I learned Llewellyn, she's got a really sexy voice. She sounds like Lauren Bacall, man.
That's
I'm telling you.
I was thinking
engaged.
The same thing when she was talking. I said.
Well, also, I learned Siegel was no choir boy. He invented Vegas. The most important thing about Siegel is he raised the ante in that Sin City. And, Vegas has become a resort destination because of Siegel and guys like Alan Smiley. It brought the attention to this modern Sodom and Gomorrah and created a sort of, a sense of illicit excitement about this town. Anyway, she has a fascinating story to tell, and I'm really looking forward to that book she's going to write. It's going to be a great read. Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beat This Day in Crime History segment. Hey, Ronnie, 40 years ago today, in Londonderry, Northern Ireland, 13 unarmed civil rights demonstrators are shot dead by British Army paratroopers in an event that becomes known as Bloody Sunday. The protesters of all Northern Catholics were marching in a protest of the British policy of internment of suspended Irish nationalists. British authorities had ordered the march banned and sent troops to confront the demonstrators when it went ahead. The soldiers fired indiscriminately into the crowd of protesters, killing 13 and wounding 17. Hey, Ronnie, this was gruesome. Any thoughts?
Yeah, you use the term Londonderry. If you're a Catholic, you'd use the term Derry to describe the city. That's how dysfunctional the history has been.
Yeah, you spent a lot of time over there.
Oh, yeah. I lived a year in Ireland, and I was back several times back in the 80s. I was there when Bobby Sands, just about the time Bobby Sands committed suicide. So, it was an incredibly tense time. The killings brought worldwide tension to the crisis, but, no one was ever convicted. The British exonerated
the troops that did it, and it was a dark blot on Irish history. And but it's turned around. I mean, I want to go back to Ireland now because and Northern Ireland because of the changed political climate.
Yeah, you think Bobby Sands died in vain when he committed suicide after 48 days?
It's kind of hard to say, you know, because everything's accumulative when you're talking about historical events. But he was a martyr, and he's revered. I remember once being in Northern Ireland, and somebody walked in wanting money to donate to the Bobby Sands something or other. So he's a deep memory in the Catholic conscience in Northern Ireland.
Absolutely. I think
he deserves
a statue there, some bronze statue of this guy. Anyway, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for February the 9th, where we'll have our very special guest, Sylvia Longmire, author of The Cartel, The Coming Invasion of Mexico's Drug Wars. The border security expert will take us behind the scenes of this deadly drug war. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar, or put it on your fridge, put it on your BlackBerry. You won't want to miss this one. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. For all of you out there, you could listen to all our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First Radio Network. Wherever you are, we would like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chapsick and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.